Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Greetings, music nerds, and welcome to Season 6 of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. I am your host, Steve Dawson, coming to you from the Hen House Studio here in Nashville, Tennessee. I'm really excited to be bringing you this new season of shows coming to you on the first and third Wednesdays of every month. I have a great lineup of fascinating conversations with incredible musicians, songwriters, guitarists, steel guitarists, drummers, composers, who knows what else. I've been having an incredible time diving deep with these folks, and I know you're going to enjoy listening. Just a reminder that this year I've taken out the short song samples through the show, as things have gotten way more complicated as far as legal use of music goes, so I'll be making an accompanying Spotify playlist to each episode, which you'll find in the episode's show notes and at the website at makersandshakerspodcast.com. So anytime you hear this cute little slide guitar sound, you'll know there's a track to go along with it on the playlist. We have some new sponsors this year, but continue to be largely listener-supported. Your help in keeping the show going is always appreciated, and you can do it with a one-time donation or a Patreon subscription. Patreon is a monthly payment of your choice, and when you sign up for that, you get a bit of added content as well as an ad-free version of the show to listen to. If you don't feel like kicking in any dough, that's cool too, but you can help by subscribing for free on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, or just spread the word by sharing the show, following us on Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, and telling all your pals about it. You can get links to all this stuff, of course, at makersandshakerspodcast.com. Meanwhile, many thanks to our sponsors this season. Please check them out and let them know that I sent you. They are Isotope, Ear Trumpet Labs, Union Tube and Transistor, Black Mountain Picks, and Spectra 1964. Hey folks and music nerds, welcome back to season 6 of the show. This is episode number 124. Today, I am bringing you a conversation with one of the most legendary pedal steel players around. You may not know his name, or maybe you do, but his name is Russ Paul. And Russ is one of the most recorded pedal steel players in modern times, as well as being in demand for his guitar and even his banjo skills, as we will hear. He's played on all those great T-Bone Burnett-produced records of the past bunch of years, including the new Robert Plant Alison Krauss album, but he's also recorded for the likes of Sturgill Simpson, Carrie Underwood, Dierks Bentley, Nora Jones, Blake Shelton, Orville Peck, Marcus King, CeeLo Green, Yola, Jim Lauderdale, Buddy Miller, and the list literally goes on and on. For someone as busy as he is, there's kind of a dearth of information out there on him, so we're going to fix that today. He doesn't have a website. He doesn't really have an internet presence at all, although he's made some cool videos lately of him playing. But he's had a really interesting career. From his early days cutting teeth in country bands around Minneapolis to, crazily, meeting Ralph Mooney at a gig who introduced him to the pedal steel, showed him the pedal steel very first time. He moved to Nashville in the 80s and kind of struggled in the world of, you know, recording demos and playing crappy bar gigs for years. But he managed to hone his craft and develop a sound. And I love that in this interview, he kind of says that for him, his career just wasn't ready to take off. It wasn't his time until he was in his 50s. He managed to score a gig with Dickie Betts in the late 80s, of the Allman Brothers, of course. And that led to more work with other songwriters around Nashville here, including Don Williams, which is super cool. And then Buddy Miller started calling him for his productions, and Vince Gill brought Russ in for his live band for about 5 years. And it seems like after about 2000 or so, the floodgates just kind of opened. And when somebody wanted a steel player here in Nashville that didn't play the same licks as everybody else and had kind of a creative approach, Russ was the guy to call. Russ and I met up at the Russell Hotel here in East Nashville, and we had a great conversation and get into all that stuff. And we also nerd out a bit on aspects of his steels, his instruments, his amps and effects. It's all quite thrilling, really, and we're going to jump right into it. Usually at this point, I tell you where you can find more info on the folks on this show, but Russ really has no website, and I don't really know where to direct you to. But if you want to see his massive list of credits, which is pretty epic, you can go to allmusic.com and look him up there. Before we get going, I'd just like to shout out the following folks who made donations or signed up to the Patreon over the last couple of weeks. Jim Davison and Ashley Reed Smith. Many thanks, guys. I could not do it without you. All right, let's get down to it. Enjoy my conversation with Russ Paul. Well, thanks for doing this.
Sure.
I'm a big fan. I play steel as well. So we're going to talk a little nerdy.
Okay.
I don't usually get too nerdy on this podcast.
Okay,
it's
okay.
General like recording and music and stuff like that. But with steel players, I've had some steel players on and we get pretty.
It's early in the year. So we can, you know, we have some free nerd points.
All right, good. Before we start with anything else, you were just, when we were blabbing here before we started, you were talking about whining pickups.
Right.
Do tell. Do you have like equipment for that?
Actually, it's getting more elaborate, but I've been doing it about 10, 12 years. Scared me yesterday. I looked into a box of, kind of my pickup graveyard, and I saw that, there's a bunch that I wound that didn't work. And then I realized there was a whole other layer underneath it. There's hundreds of them, but.
Guitar pickups and steel, or
guitar pickups and steel pickups, and I've rewound some steel pickups. I kind of got my own take on steel pickups these days. Real low output, kind of like the old Fenders.
That's what I'm looking for, something like that. I've gone through like two or three during COVID. I started getting like really into trying to find tones and
whatever.
And I swapped them out a few times, and all the new ones are so hot.
Yeah.
And it just like, it's not like I end up having to put a pedal that can actually turn the guitar down before the amp. Right.
Well, I don't know the history too much, but pedal steel pickups, I think, started out on the cooler side.
Yeah.
Like the old Fenders.
Yeah.
You know, to get nerdy, they're around 10,000. Ohms.
Mm-hmm.
And a guitar pickup, like a Telecaster pickup, might be 6,000 or 7,000 ohms.
Right.
That's kind of standard guitar range. A humbucker's in there.
But that's where the original Fender steel ones were?
Around 10,000 or so.
Okay.
And they started ramping up, and a lot of the modern steel pickups are like 15, 16, 17 to like 22,000. And these numbers are all pretty loose, but kind of the hotter you get a bigger sound, more low end, but more mid range, and you start losing high end. But what I've, over the last probably 8 or 10 years, I've sort of been scaling back, and I'm a guitar player too.
Yeah.
So I got frustrated because I wanted to play my steel guitar through guitar pedals.
Yeah.
And
it just freaks them out,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, just nothing really sounded good. The distortion always sounded just real ganky. And I started experimenting. And then, a number of years ago, I, as a hobby, started kind of messing with winding pickups. And now I'm winding a pickup that I've been using now pretty much exclusively for the last 3 or 4 years, which is about 10,000 ohms mm-hmm. on my pedal steel. And it's all about scale, because if you have a 15,000 ohm pickup, you play through it, you set your Fender amp on about 3, and that seems to be where the thing is. Well, with the 10,000 ohm, you just put the amp up one more notch, and it kind of makes up for it. But in the process, before the amp, you can run through like guitar pedals, and suddenly that's what they were designed for. So suddenly they start working really, they become real friendly.
Yeah. I've had this weird thing the last couple of weeks where, I don't know if you've ever experienced this. I've been, like, I took everything out of the chain just to see what was happening, mm-hmm. but I ran my steel into a pedal. It actually happens with all pedals, and into my amp, and it's okay. It's like, it's way too hot, mm-hmm. but it's okay. But if I plug it into a DI, mm-hmm. the volume goes up by like 20 or 30 dB.
Wow.
It's like some crazy thing that's happening in the impedance, maybe. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I don't know. I don't know that stuff well enough to.
Well,
but it's weird.
To be honest with you, I don't know much about it either. But okay. I think I know what I like to hear, so I just keep playing around, and I found that there's a lot of this stuff you can do without blowing stuff up.
Right.
I've blown up my fair share of equipment over the years,
yeah.
but I'm just kind of I've got a pretty knuckleheaded approach to the whole thing. But I find that I don't quit till I get what I want. So you just keep doing it and keep doing it. And eventually you start to see the patterns. And
so how did you come across the equipment that you need to wind pickups?
Oh, just get online. In fact, I just bought a tensioning device. Usually you just feed it with your fingers, and I was having some issues.
Yeah.
And I started digging, and I realized there's a whole industry out there of coil winding, you know, coils, you know, which is what a steel or what a pickup is.
Yep.
But also coils are in anything electronic, and
yep,
they wind really fine wire. And there's this whole industry of equipment for coil winding.
Oh.
And so I found a used one on eBay for like $80, a tensioner, which is, you know, made for some industrial use. But I found one. I hooked it up earlier this week, and my wife, in fact, got a little miffed with me because I just got lost in the workshop for about 2 days. And
that happens.
But I figured it out. It came with a manual that was in Chinese.
Really?
So it didn't do me much good. So
yeah.
I just kept hammering, just banging my head against the wall, and I got it working. And yesterday was just very pleasant day of pickup.
So it kind of like, it feeds the wire across the spool,
right,
kind of?
Right, it goes through, and it's like we were talking about sewing machines earlier. It's just all about, it goes around a bunch of little wheels, and some places, it's just, each one gradually controls it a little more. So never in one place,
right,
but there's a little friction, and you get to where you can control it, yeah.
Amazing.
And you can adjust it, and then you find the sweet spot.
Yeah.
And all is great.
So how much experimenting did it take to find that you could build a pickup that you were like, yeah, this is the shit, man?
It took a while.
Yeah.
Boxes of pickups. But
so you were rewinding old pickups.
I was rewinding old pickups, and then I bought a milling machine a few years ago, a little milling machine.
You're so in deep, man.
Well, my dad was a machinist. I grew up with this business. I don't know what I'm doing, but I grew up in the machinist culture.
Uh-huh.
So I was able to make my own bobbins. And then I have a friend works at Joe Glazer's shop,
yep,
who was experimenting with their new laser cutting machine. And he said, do you need some pickup bobbins made? And said, do I?
So yeah.
I actually have a bunch now for pedal steel pickups.
Amazing.
And so I buy the magnets from one place online up in Indiana. I buy the wire from another place. The internet is used to be, there was a place in Nashville called Randolph and Rice, which was a electronics shop where all the studios went to and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And you could buy all your stuff, and they shut down maybe 10 years ago, and I was lost. And then, you know, you get online, it's all there.
Wow. Okay, so you mentioned that your dad was a machinist. Now, you're a hard guy to find information on. There's like nothing. There's no website. There's like, you're invisible out there. So now I know you're originally from Minneapolis, right?
Right.
Okay,
right.
So you grew up there. Your dad was a machinist.
Yeah.
How'd you get into music?
Just, I had two older sisters that back in the early 60s were big fans of Peter, Paul, and Mary and Theodore Bacall, the folk scare, they called it, the folk boom. And they had a little acoustic guitar, and I sort of picked it up and started, you know, figuring out some chords. And this was about 3 or 4 months before the Beatles were on Ed Sullivan. So
it's
I was about 9 or 10.
Mm-hmm.
I saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. It was like a brick in the forehead. But I was already playing guitar, so it was like, oh, that's what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
And
but an acoustic guitar doesn't really cut it.
Well, there's a story there. I saw that they had these guitars with what I call horns on them, cutaways, and looked like knobs and everything. And I didn't know what they did, but I did come home the next day. That was a Sunday evening. Next day I came home from school, went down into my dad's little workshop, and cut a cutaway into our Silvertone acoustic, and I glued some knobs on it. Yeah, because I didn't know that. You know,
they actually did anything.
Yeah. But no,
but
I was
cool.
Pretty eat up with it early on.
Uh-huh. Wow, cool.
And that hasn't stopped. So.
Yeah. So you've been tweaking. You're like a little J.J. Cale down there.
Yeah. Yeah. And my guitars tend to be rat's nest, as he once said. Yeah. But it's just, I think one of the most important things for a musician or any artist, but a musician is to find a voice that you have, because there's so many really good players out there that they get lost in the weeds because they don't have a voice.
Yep.
They might play really good, but they might sound more like somebody else that they already know.
Totally.
And it's like, so it's okay. Maybe you can go out and play in somebody's road band or something. But if you want to really forge ahead, you've got to develop a voice.
Which is something that you did here in Nashville. So were you already on that path and before you came here? I don't know when you moved here.
I moved here in the mid-80s.
Okay.
And
so what was happening up to that point in Minneapolis?
I was doing my first 10,000 hours. Since I was about 12, I've been playing weekends in taverns and bars and all through high school. And
guitar? Or were you playing
guitar?
Steel?
Well, when I was about 15, I was playing in a little country trio, quartet. And we had a regular Sunday night gig at this ballroom where they had a deal with a booker that these Nashville bands were coming through town and generally had Sunday nights off, so they'd book them there. So
okay.
This ballroom, well, we were the house band kind of, so we would open, you know, play a couple, play a warm-up set, and then between their shows, play another set.
Oh, wow, cool.
And one night, a guy named Wynn Stewart
from
California came and played.
This is in the 70s?
This is like 1967, maybe.
So he's like kind of in his
current,
prime then.
He's current.
Yeah.
Well, he had a guy playing in his band. Very interesting. And
Paul Brumley?
No, Ralph Mooney.
Oh, Ralph Mooney, right.
Ralph was just out on it. I think they were old buddies, so it was a good excuse to go out and drink. So, but Ralph came up to me after our first set and said, "Kid, you're playing the wrong instrument." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, you're over there playing," and I think I had some kind of Gretsch or something, and I had discovered light gauge strings.
Yeah.
And he said, "You're bending all those strings all over the place." He said, "You need to play one of these things." And he pointed to his steel, which was his old Fender, I think 1000, whatever.
Yep.
The, you know, with the moon, half moon on it and everything. He said, "This will do the job for you." I said, "Well, you show me." He said, "Yeah, hang around
Come
afterwards."
On.
So,
did you know who he was?
No.
Holy shit, man.
Yeah, I was a Beatle kid, you know, but I happened to be playing with a country band.
How old would he have been then? Like in his 40s or something?
Yeah, I would
maybe?
Say he was probably 40s.
Okay.
If that, you know.
Yep.
So,
wow.
At the end of the night, he said, "Come over here, kid." And he sat me down. He said, "Sit behind this thing." And the first thing he did, he got out a half pint of whiskey out of his pocket and said, "Have a swig of this." You know, and I was like 15 or 14 or something.
Okay.
So I took a swig and...
That's how you start
playing pedal steel. And he showed me the basic, using the first two pedals. Mm-hmm. And I went, "Oh, like that?" He said, "Yep, you got it." And that was it. And the next day, which was a Monday... All these cool things happened to me on Sunday
evening. Yeah, it seems like it.
And then Monday, the bass player, who was my best friend, he was 2 years older than me. He had a driver's license. We skipped out of school that afternoon. Somebody had said there was a pawn shop in North Minneapolis. We were out in the western suburbs. And we went down to this Buddy Ryan's pawn shop, you know, in the dark bowels of North Minneapolis.
Sounds sketchy.
And, yes. And there was this pawn shop run by a little person, I guess, you know, we called them midgets at the time. He played steel guitar and he ran this pawn shop. He had a homemade two-pedal
steel. Short one?
No, this one. He stood up and played it, kind of. But
wow.
No, it was just something he had in his pawn shop. And somebody had told me that there was a steel guitar there. So I bought this homemade used pedal steel that afternoon.
Amazing.
And Friday night I was playing it at the gig.
Was it a 10 string or what
was it?
It was
a 10 string.
Yeah.
It had two pedals, no knee levers. And first thing I did was realize I didn't like the sound of the pickup, and I pirated a couple of Fender single coil pickups. It was 10 strings, so I just put two of them side by side.
Sure.
And, you know, so that began really early. But
wow.
And I took right to it. You know, I wasn't playing anything fancy, but I got it. It made sense to me.
So you sort of fashioned the steel so it had two pedals, no knee levers.
Right.
Were you, did you get pretty deeply into the whole steel thing quickly? Like, were you learning stuff off records?
I was kind of learning stuff off of hippie records and stuff. And then
Garcia stuff? Or
well, this was kind of, this was before almost that. Before Garcia. So it was, I remember the Youngbloods. Elephant Mountain. No, there was a, was it Elephant Mountain? There was another album, but they had a couple songs with primitive steel on it. Good primitive.
Who would have played on that?
Their keyboard player, a guy named Banana, who's actually on
I did a gig with Banana.
Oh, cool, yeah. Well, he...
he played steel,
He played steel, and it was very rudimentary, but it was
effective.
It was very effective.
Yeah.
In fact, going back a little further than that, I think it was before I started playing steel, the Love and Spoonful's first single, Do You Believe in Magic, had the guitar riff, which was a steel guitar riff.
Really?
Well, to me it was.
Okay.
It was that whole tone.
Yep.
And he wasn't bending it, but he was playing it like aping. And the first time I heard that, I was with my older sister was driving. My mom was in the front seat. I was in the back seat, and the radio was on. And that song came on the radio, and it resonated. So I jumped over the seat to turn it up. And still to this day, that is the essence of what pedal steel is that whole tone change, that first pedal.
Yeah.
That's where all, you know, that's where it all is. That's what it's all about. Everything else is gravy.
The A pedal.
The A pedal is just, it's the apex, you know, it's the whole thing.
Now, you only have two pedals on your steels.
Yeah.
So you don't have the C pedal.
I did for years.
But you just never used it.
I just never felt it, I could get it tuned right. It felt awkward, and I always thought, man, somebody, you know, this ought to be on another pedal or something. The fourth string should, you know, raise independently.
Yeah.
So maybe 10, 15 years ago, I just put it on an E lever.
So what levers do you have on your steels, or are they different?
Well, I have four levers.
Yeah.
And three of them operate the
E to F, E flat.
E to F, E to E flat, and then E to F sharp. So three of my knee levers just all deal with just the fourth and eighth string.
Okay.
And then my other knee lever just drops the second string a half tone.
Standard.
That's it. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So the two pedal thing just stuck ever since.
It stuck. Well, that's how I started. And that third pedal always felt odd to me. And somebody told me once that Mooney maybe had a pedal over on the right side of his guitar that did that. Or something like that.
You mean like for his other foot?
Yeah, to reach over, you know. So it always made sense to me, and it's still to this day. I mean, I was doing some overdub at the house yesterday, and I realized how much I just have. I'll be playing, and I can just, that is just this great little expression in all kinds of positions to raise that fourth string. I also raise the eighth, the whole tone, too. The eighth string.
The E to E flat, or to F sharp.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, cool.
So, yeah, all three levers just do the same thing to the octaves.
Right.
And
interesting.
It's very expressive.
Yeah.
It's very expressive. It's the whole tone change.
Right.
It's another one. So you have the, because with the Donegan, the third pedal, you just have more combinations. It's much more in tune to me. Mm-hmm.
At what point were you kind of dedicating yourself to steel, like when you're playing in bands in Minneapolis and stuff? Like,
yeah, I just, you know.
Before you were 20 years old or?
Oh, yeah. No, okay. I was 15, 14,
you're deep.
15.
Yeah.
And I, you know, always kind of played both. For a while there, my steel got stolen. So I probably went for 6 or 8 months without a steel. But,
oh, what a drag.
Yeah. And,
did you end up getting a good one after that?
After that, I got a Fender double neck, Fender. And then I,
tens or eight, eight,
that
strings
was eight.
Eights,
and, yeah. And then, I think I got, then I had a series of 10 strings. I had a lot of steels, you know, just different ones.
So were you ever playing like hardcore country stuff?
Yeah.
You were.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. This band I played with, mean, I was in, you know, garage rock bands. Yeah. But then this one band, when I was about 14, called me up, said, we need a guitar player Friday night, which was that evening. And because our cousin plays guitar, but he's laid up drunk somewhere. Mm-hmm. And we heard you play pretty good guitar. So they came and picked me up because I didn't drive yet. And this is before I played steel, but I went out and played with them. And I ended up playing with them for a couple of years. Oh. And it was two brothers. One played drums. The other one was a lead singer and played a cordovox, which is an accordion with a Lowry organ unit built in.
Far out.
So
I want one.
Oh, it's great. So he played, we did, you know, this is Minnesota, so we did modern, yep. which was like Be Johnny Be Good or, you know, kind of, okay. you know, basic rock and roll. Country, this guy sang like Merle Haggard songs and stuff.
Okay.
And old time, which was polkas and waltzes, which okay. was, my biggest surprise when I moved to Tennessee was they don't know what polkas or right. waltzes are here. It's yeah. just very foreign. Mm-hmm. But I grew up in this culture where we knew, you know, that was part of what you played.
Yeah, I'm from Canada, so Walter Ostenek, man, like I know all about the polka world.
Yep, yep. And I still love that stuff. Yeah. You know? I still listen to Whoopi John, the Six Fat Dutchman.
Love it. So what brought on the move to Nashville? Like at what point did you say, like, I got to get out of here? Is that what happened? Or
yeah, I played played from when I got out of high school, I averaged about seven nights a week playing in clubs.
That's
in
a lot of nights.
From 72 to about 84 for about 12 years. The average comes out because I played all the time. I was in two or three bands mm-hmm. and we would play club gigs where we'd play six nights a week
yep.
and we might play in a club for 3 months.
Wow.
You know,
all in Minneapolis?
Yeah, all in Minneapolis. I never traveled. We just
always really?
And there was a lot of work.
Those days are so gone.
A lot of I made good money yep. for a kid, you know. Yep. I was single and I played, yeah, you know, like I played 12 years in rock bands, country bands, disco bands, all kinds of stuff.
Were you playing more guitar generally or
it all depended. Yep. Sometimes I had I was in a rock band and I had my steel and I had a Leslie 145 that nice. I modded, you know, primitively yeah. to play organ parts.
God, so, you're hauling that around to every gig. Okay.
Yeah, we used Jesus. To haul in. We hauled a PA. We had everything. So, so I did that, and then about 84, I realized I was the big frog in a small pond, and I didn't have any reason to get better because I was good enough. I could have just gone on playing there, and. Yeah. I think I would have probably drank myself to death. So yeah. I thought I need to go somewhere. So I went to Nashville.
Did you know anyone here?
Not really, no.
Okay. And so what was that like? Like, what was the scene in Nashville like at the time? And what was your life like as a young person coming here at that time?
Oh, it was great. I had saved a little money.
Yep.
I came down in my little Japanese pickup truck with a little camper on it, like mm-hmm. all drummers or steel players had at the time. And I had a friend of a friend who lived here. So I had somebody to call and say, hey, I'm in town. Can I crash on your couch?
Yep.
And it turned out that the little apartment right next to theirs was coming up for rent. So okay. I just secured that. And the first couple months, every night about 9 o'clock, I had a double neck Fender in one hand and a Session 400 in the other hand, and I went around to all the little nightclubs.
Really?
And I would just go in, can I come and sit in with your band? I'll set up on the dance floor. I'd play for an hour or so, yeah. and then I'd take off and go to another one. And I just did that.
Man.
Every night.
Ballsy.
But what happened was that eventually somebody go, oh, well, hey, Friday night, I got to do an Opry spot. Can you sub for me? And okay.
So what was the club scene like?
Oh, well, there was a number of these clubs. There was a place called Gabe's. There was the Rose Room. There was, this is like 84, maybe 85.
Were these like Broadway clubs or?
Yeah,
or?
But they, yeah, were around town, not Broadway. Broadway was Skid Row at the time. That was a pretty dangerous place. But they were around in, you know, different areas of town, Hermitage, yeah. Trinity Lane, out by Opryland.
There was, oh, there was,
yeah.
Okay, yeah.
And so I would you know, I ended up kind of getting gigs, and I had I met a lot of people, and a lot of friends of mine had played for Opry acts. Mm-hmm. So they would go out and do a little touring. They'd do Opry shows, but they'd play in clubs. There was a whole club scene of a bunch of us musicians that were all kind of new to town. And it was these people were – it was about country music, you know, and then
– So you moved here in 84, you said?
84, yeah, 84. Late 84. Yeah.
So country was sort of starting to change at that point, I guess. That was transition time.
Yeah, yeah. It was pretty much in full swing. The Opry was roaring. The Nashville Network, the
was
TV
the Opry thing. At
It was
Opryland?
At the new place. Yeah, yeah, that's been there, I think, since 72 or something.
Okay, right.
And, the Ryman was shut down, I think. That they almost condemned it.
Yeah.
I started, just hanging around with these different people. And then I started, somebody said, you need to meet songwriters. Because I wanted to be a session musician.
Okay. So that was a goal.
That was a goal. And I recognized that I would probably have to go through a process, and I realized, well, maybe I need to get like an Opry gig, which I never did get, but maybe a road gig. And early on, I started getting to know songwriters, because I heard if you can play on demo sessions, then people will hear the demos and go, I need that guy, I need that guy. And I thought that would happen really fast. Well, it's not that fast, but it did work. But so I started getting to know songwriters. And
how? Just showing up at like rounds and stuff?
Yeah, just, through where they, somebody would, a friend introduced me one night at one of the bars. Here's a guy named Dave Gibson, who was, writing some hit songs at the time. And we became pals, and I started playing on his demo. I played guitar.
Demos that he was doing, like, were people at home at this point, or were they using Music Row studios and stuff?
He had a publishing deal, and we would go, was it Gene Breeden's? Oh, I'm trying to, anyhow, it was a studio with an old 8-track Ampex that only 7 tracks worked, and you could punch in, but you couldn't punch out.
It's limiting in a cool way.
So, so that was the kind of stuff. And we'd spend days there. And that's where I met Craig Wiseman, who's one of the biggest songwriters ever. Well, that was back when he was playing drums in a club band. And we became friends and wrote songs together. And we would find free studio time at these little rundown studios and work on recording and stuff. So then through a friend.
Who were the main steel players in town at that time?
At the time, Sonny Gerrish. Mm-hmm. Paul Franklin was already.
He would be a youngster, though.
He was a youngster, but he was already had his feet in really deep.
Yeah.
Buddy Emmons was still around. You could go see Buddy Emmons playing at the Hall of Fame Inn. Or Paul Franklin. They kind of they shared the same gig, And Weldon was still playing.
Okay.
Hal Rugg was still playing.
Amazing. Did you get to know some of those guys?
A little bit. Not a whole lot. Mm-hmm. Not a whole lot. I was pretty much in awe. I was pretty embarrassed to.
Well, that's a thing, right? Like, for anybody coming to a town like this, you see somebody like Paul Franklin or I guess Buddy, I never saw Buddy Emmons, but like I've seen Paul Franklin enough to question why I would play the pedal steel.
Right. And you just, and what do I really have to say to this guy? But I better pay attention because he knows something I don't because he's working all the time and he's playing on records.
Yeah.
So.
And were you getting, like when you got called to do a session, were they wanting somebody to sound like Paul Franklin?
Oh, there would be times. Yeah, there was the whole. There's the arc of a session player is like, who's so and so, and then get me so and so. Got to have so and so. Then we need somebody a young so and so, and then it's back
a
to
cheaper so and so.
Yes. And so there was a lot of that, and my wife is the daughter of a very successful session guitarist.
Oh, yeah.
And, she always said, his name is Billy Sanford. He played on a million records.
For
my
sure.
wife's name is Ginger. And we've been married 30 years. And she had enough insight, you know, I sometimes go, why didn't it happen earlier? Why did it happen? And she said, you're not going to happen before your time. Mm-hmm. It's just going to be, maybe you're not ready, mm-hmm. you know, this and that. Cause I worked my way up to where I started playing some demos. I got into a couple, did some touring with some different people.
What kind of tours were you doing?
Well, my first gig, first time I ever got on a bus, was pretty early on. I had a friend who knew Dickie Betts.
Oh, yeah. And, I got it. Yeah. We got to talk about this.
And Dickie was living in town in Nashville at the time. He had just gone through Cumberland Heights. Yeah. So he was clean.
Okay.
And
a rehab?
Yeah.
Okay.
And he was living here at a friend's house. And
this is like pre-Pattern Disruptive Dickie Betts? Like
I don't know exactly. This was post Highway Call on this.
I love that record, Highway Call, man. That's like one of my favorite.
John Huey. Oh. Beautiful stuff.
Killer. But this is pre-Warren Haynes, obviously.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so I went and played on a demo.
How did that come up?
Through a friend of mine I knew from Minnesota who had come to town earlier than I, and he played Danny Parks, and he played fiddle out with Dickie on the road,
right.
And he gave Dickie my number, and Dickie called me. He wanted me to come put some steel guitar on this demo he was doing of a country song called "Too Late to Go Home Early."
Okay,
so I met him in a studio and played on the demo, and
how was it? Was it intimidating, or was it like?
Oh,
was he cool?
He was cool. He was great. And
were you just overdubbing?
Just overdubbing. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember it because I was probably so scared, which is so in the moment. But
how long after you moved to Nashville did that happen?
This was a couple months. It was pretty quick.
Yeah.
So.
And I guess Dickie Betts wasn't exactly like a hot commodity at that point either,
no,
right?
He was kind of in a slump.
Yeah.
And he wanted to do, he was hooked up with a management here in Nashville. So he kind of wanted to do a country thing.
Yeah. I mean, that's what he was sort of doing up until the late 80s.
So a few weeks later, his management called me and said, Dickie's going to go to some tours. You want to, how would you like to go out? I said, yeah. So I went out for, better part of a year.
Wasn't Vassar Clemens in his band for a while?
That was earlier.
Okay.
This one, John Yudkin played fiddle. Okay. Johnny Neal played organ.
Wow. Okay.
It was a really good band.
Yeah.
And we had between the fiddle and Johnny Neal and the keyboards and the steel and Dickie, we had all the Allman Brother parts worked out in 3 and 4 parts.
Amazing.
It was really cool.
You were just playing steel for him?
Just playing steel.
The whole night?
Just playing steel, yep.
Wow.
So, because he was playing so much and it was just...
You would play like Jessica?
Yeah, we played Jessica, stuff.
All the Dickie...
Pretty much I was playing the parts, and then I was playing what I called expression in places, but I didn't really do much soloing or anything. That was,
okay.
Leave that to Dickie, and I kind of underplayed in that end.
Yeah.
But
how loud was it?
It was pretty loud, but I was, he was loud as hell. I mean, he had a Marshall 50 watt with JBL speakers.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
And he was, when he was on, he was very mercurial. So it was like he was... either the best in the world or pretty damn lame. Just depend on his mood.
Really, yeah.
And he was dabbling in sobriety, and I think the whole thing was a challenge for him.
Yeah,
but I worked with him for...
Was that like hardcore touring, or was it pretty sporadic?
No, it was just we'd go out for a week here or there, but it was cool because we played mostly kind of rock clubs.
What kind of a few hundred people at that point, or was it bigger than that?
It was bigger than that. We played like the Stone Pony in Asbury Park. I don't even remember the name of the clubs, but... You know, it was my first time on a tour bus. It was great.
You know,
I was young. And
that's super cool, man. What a great gig.
So then I came back to town and kept clubbing and stuff. And then I ended up working with a guy named Michael Johnson, mm-hmm. who was a singer who had a couple Nashville hits. He was more of a kind of a really cool folk singer.
Yeah.
And did that. And then I worked with Don Williams for about 3 years.
Wow.
I was the only steel player to ever play on the road with him.
He just called you?
This Michael Johnson, we opened a short tour for Don up in Canada, and I got to know the guy. That's where I met my father-in-law. He was out playing guitar with him, and mm-hmm. I became friends with a few of the people in the band. And the next year they called me up and said, well, Don would love to have you come and play in the band.
Wow, so cool.
I went and did that. I did that for 3 years.
Yeah.
And that was great. Great band.
Like three full years of
touring.
Wow.
And one of the best road bands you'll ever, I mean, they played so soft. It was my first realize that you do not need to play loud.
Right.
And
so at that point in your career, what were you playing? Like what kind of steel and what kind of amps were you playing?
When I was still in Minneapolis, I had a friend named Clem Schmitz who had a steel guitar store called the Steel Guitar Emporium in Minneapolis. He was an Emmons dealer.
Okay.
And he's an ace Emmons mechanic. He's written a book on it and everything. Yeah. And so I really got heavily into push-pull Emmons guitars.
Okay.
And so I bought one of the last push-pulls made before they went over to
the '70s
late
60s.
No, this is early 80s.
Oh, early 80s. Okay.
80, 81.
They're still making them then, eh?
Yeah.
Okay.
And this is one of the last ones. I still have it. It's a beautiful guitar.
Hmm.
Heavily modified, of course.
But, yeah.
I was playing through a twin reverb.
Okay.
No effects at the time. I was playing really...
Real straight.
Straightforward.
And were you playing the C6 neck too, or...?
When I came to Nashville, I would go see Paul Franklin and Buddy Emmons and realize I never understood the C6. I could play stuff on it. I could play, but I never really got into it. So
it's kind of disheartening seeing this guy.
Yeah. I took the back neck off, sold the parts to Clem, and I kind of paid my rent for a few months with the parts. I guess I have to say I paid my rent with a C6 for a few months.
Literally.
Bad little joke, yeah. But
so you just had a hole in it, or you put a pad in it?
I had a hole in it. It's still got a hole in
it.
Wow,
cool.
It's great.
Yeah.
But I've been a push-pull guy. I still am.
Yeah.
I met Jeff Surratt and got started working with him maybe 10 years ago. I would kind of have these design ideas, and he's humored me, and he's built me three or four guitars. And that's mostly what I play now is one of Jeff's guitars.
What are they called?
Show Pro.
He's Show Pro. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, yeah, like anytime I've seen footage of you, which there isn't a ton of that I know of, but there's like a pink one.
Yeah.
That's one of them?
That's my main guitar.
That's your main one. Okay. So here's what I've noticed about it. There's two pedals. There's volume and tone controls. There's two pickups, right?
There's two pickups on it. There's
Do you have a pickup selector, like a Tele kind of thing?
Yeah, I've got a three-way switch. I designed the guitar. One of the first people I met in Nashville was a guy named Steve Hinson.
Mm-hmm.
Met him like the first night I was here. We just, you know, and we were like brothers from different mothers, you know. And he was telling me he loves to play old Emmons single necks.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I think they sound better because a double neck is basically two single necks seamed together. It's two different layers,
yep.
And it's a smaller soundboard, but the single neck is actually about a 2-inch bigger soundboard.
Uh-huh.
And so I got this idea. So the pink guitar is a single neck, but it's a big flat. It almost looks like an old Fender some ways.
Yep.
And I designed,
but there's no pad, right?
No.
It's just
a single neck.
Yeah.
It's not on a double body. It's
okay.
Like a single neck. The neck is right in the middle of this like 12 or 13 inch body.
Okay.
And then the neck, I've designed it so there's a bunch of extra area up there with a control cavity in it.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got.
Up there?
I've got a distortion unit. I have
built in.
Yeah, preamp.
Far out.
I've got various controls. I've got a Leslie speed switch. It's changed. I can take off the cover and change out whatever's in there.
That's a lot of shit in there.
Yeah, yeah. And I've got
the distortion circuit all about? Is it from like a rat or something? Or?
No, a good friend of mine, Rob McNally, is one of the top guitar players, and he's saved me so much in money because he's always trying pedals and stuff. And we have a very deep tonal relationship.
Uh-huh.
And I'll call him up and go, what do I need to be looking for? And there's a guy named Nick Greer, I think is maybe in Georgia or something.
I've got some Greer pedals.
Yeah. And it's called the Ghetto Stomp.
Okay.
And he said, you're going to like it. I think it's supposed to be like an old Supro or something, but I think it might be cool for steel. Mm-hmm. So I got one and I loved it. Mm-hmm. So I have.
It's an overdrive.
Yeah. And I just unhoused it and built it into the guitar. And
it's just sitting, the circuit is sitting there.
Sitting under a cover in the guitar.
And do you have, like, how do you activate it?
I've got a little, like, four-way selector switch that nothing, preamp, distortion, you know, I'm just switching.
What's the preamp for?
Well, using a 9 or 10,000 ohm pickup.
You need some juice.
Well, not much juice, but enough. Also, if you're going to run long cables or run through, it's just a buffer. So I do use a little bit of a clean preamp. And that's one of those EP1s.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just bought one last night. And I bought a couple of those, unhoused them, and then built it into the guitar. So.
Wow. So it runs through all that before the output jack, obviously.
Yeah. First thing, the guitar works a lot like a Telecaster. It's two pickups.
There's one volume, one tone.
Yeah. Okay. Basically, it goes first to the selector switch. Each pickup goes to the selector switch. Then it goes to a standard tone and volume, just like a guitar.
And you've got a three-way selector. So it's one pickup, other, or both.
Yeah. Okay. And then it goes from there to a tone and volume, passive.
Yeah.
And then it goes to, if I want, the distortion or the preamp.
And how much control do you have over, like, do you have all the overdrive controls that are on the pedal on the face of the guitar?
Yeah. Okay. That's right there.
Far out.
And
I love it.
And then when I go out of the guitar, I go into, you know, when I do sessions and stuff, I go into my pedal board. I don't go into the volume pedal first. I've got it divided up into tone shaping or modulation devices, then the volume control, and then like
the reverb and delays
right. and stuff.
Yeah.
So I think that's pretty standard. But and I use a Goodrich light beam pedal that they don't make anymore.
Okay.
But it's very clean.
Yeah.
No pots. Great.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
But. You know, so basically I can shape my sound before it even gets to the pedal board.
Yeah.
A lot of it.
What other kinds of pedals do you like to use these days?
I've always got a wah-wah handy.
Oh, yeah. This show is brought to you by the good folks at iZotope, who make incredible plug-in software for any music or dialogue recording situation. Among other things, they make a very unique suite of software called RX, which you can use to surgically repair almost any kind of issue in a recording. Whether it's removing electrical hum, unwanted noise, vocal plosives, or almost anything you can throw at it. I use iZotope RX on every mix in one way or another, and I love that I can get in there on guitar tracks that I'm doing and running through my crazy old tube amps and get rid of the hum and noise without affecting the actual tone of the guitar. You can buy their plugins outright or get a subscription to keep up to date on all their latest versions. Right now, they're offering listeners a 10% discount on any of their plugins when you use the code SOULPOD10 at checkout. So head on over to iZotope.com/SOULPOD, and you'll see the links right there to get the discount or an extended 30-day trial of their subscription service of Music Production Suite Pro. We're also brought to you this season by Black Mountain Picks. These are unique spring-loaded thumb picks that are super comfortable and adaptable. I've been using them for a couple years now, and I absolutely love them. They come in medium gauge, heavy gauge, jazz-tipped, left-handed, and with regular or extra-tight spring tension. Check them out at blackmountainpicks.com. Also thanks to Ear Trumpet Labs, a workshop in Portland, Oregon, hand-building amazing-sounding microphones. These large diaphragm condensers combine state-of-the-art sound with eye-catching designs and the feedback control to excel live as well as in the studio. I am using their Edwina myself right now on this podcast. Check them out at eartrumpetlabs.com. And finally, the Hen House Hang. It's a four-day immersive recording experience right here with me at the Hen House Studio in East Nashville on September 19 to 22nd, 2022. Join us for a musical learning experience like no other. We'll put you up in a groovy hotel, feed you some glorious food, show you the ropes of recording roots and Americana music by bringing you in on a real session with real musicians working on real songs from the ground up.
You can get all the info on that at stevedawson.ca. Just follow the links on the front page to the Hen House Hang. All right, then, let's get back to the show.
So you keep a wah-wah right beside your volume pedal?
Oh, or? I have a little tool kit I bring with me, and yeah. I just pop it in when I want to use it. And,
yeah.
And
but do you does it sit there beside your volume pedal?
Oh, yeah. I just scoot the volume pedal over. I usually have to put something on the volume pedal so the volume stays up.
Yeah.
But then I have a wah-wah, and yeah. I use that, I guess, in kind of unexpected ways. I think of it mm-hmm. more as a filter.
Like a filter, yeah.
I mean, I had one of the first wah-wahs that ever came to Minneapolis back in 66 or 67.
Who made it? Like Warp Morley or something?
This was just a cheap, awful thing. Yeah. But then I think I had a Vox.
Or, yeah.
But, you know, so I've been using those things for years. And yeah. most people get on it and just go back and forth.
Right.
I use it as a filter
yep.
where you hardly move your foot, but it's very expressive. And so I use that more than a person would think. People mm-hmm. kind of go, wow, are you using some sort of auto wah or anything? No, that's a wah-wah pedal.
Hmm.
And so I use that quite a bit. I have a delay museum in my house. I'm heavily into all kinds of delays.
Yeah. Do you have any favorites these days?
Oh, I just got one of the new Strymon.
Volante? Do you
have
that one? The big one?
Yeah, well.
What do you think of it?
I'm still working with it. I'm a huge Hank Marvin fan.
Okay.
And I finally realized, my God, he wasn't using it like an Echoplex. He was using one of these multi-head yep. things. So
like a Benson.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's got that. And that's kind of new. That world is new to me. I've mm-hmm. always been kind of a Echoplex
right.
guy.
Straight ahead. Like
straight ahead, one yeah. delay.
Right. You know?
So I'm starting to learn that now. So that's pretty exciting. But I've got a couple tape delays. I've got an old tube Echoplex. I've got yep. The full tone tape delay.
Yep. Yep.
But I've also got, I love Boss. You know, anything Boss makes is mm-hmm. worth having.
Yep.
Strymon is great.
Yeah.
You know, just I have a lot of stuff.
What about amps these days? What do you use?
I'm a Fender. I grew up playing Blackface Fender amps.
Yep.
Now my favorite amps are the Drip Edge, you know, Fenders. I have like three Drip Edge Princetons. That's my favorite mm-hmm. amp. And I toured for 5 years with Vince Gill in a huge band. I played a little Fender Deluxe the whole time. Just a tiny little amp. I set it up.
So how do you get enough stage volume?
You put the amp close so you can hear it.
Uh-huh.
And then you might have a little bit coming back through your monitor. But for the most part, play, just let the PA do the work. That's what I learned when I worked with Don Williams.
Okay.
Is that you don't fill the room with a PA. You just get your sound and then let the sound guy turn you up.
Yeah, yeah. But you never in that situation have a problem hearing yourself without having to turn the amp up so much that you're freaking it out.
If you start turning a little amp like that up, then it starts distorting.
Yeah.
It doesn't sound good. No, so you learn to play at that low volume
mm-hmm.
and that's where all the sweet spots are.
Yeah, yeah.
And
because a deluxe needs to be on like 3 or 4 to sound
yeah yeah you know it's usually about 2 or 3
steel. Yeah okay
and,
well
you know and I worked with Vince for 5 years and I know Vince had John Huey he's you know
yeah
he and Paul Franklin are tight as hell and I know I'm not in that league but the only criticism he ever had of me was you're not loud enough
really
I figured that's a pretty good criticism.
Vince probably doesn't play super loud, does he?
Oh, he can you know,
yeah.
Yeah, you know, he gets excited, you know, but what a cool gig that was.
Yeah, so what led up to that gig?
I was friends with Michael Rhodes, the bass yep. player. We were doing a session one day. This was like Thursday afternoon. And he said, man, we need somebody to come out with Vince this weekend.
So why wasn't Paul Franklin doing it?
Oh, this was, Paul was, you know.
Or he was out with Dire Straits or something?
No,
at this
he was
point,
just
or?
Doing sessions.
Okay,
you know, he was yeah. still, and so I ended up going out, and I ended up being there for 5 years. So,
wow. You
know, and it was great. I mean, one of the greatest, you know. What
like in the 90s? Or
No, this was about 2005, I think.
Oh, wow, okay, yeah.
Till about 2010 in there.
Wow.
And we toured quite a bit. And,
yeah.
I mean, what a dream gig for a steel player.
Right.
You know, our shows were like 3 or 4 hours long,
yeah.
or 2 or 3 hours long. The first hour would be just solid country gold. I mean, just
amazing.
Vince singing. And no holds barred, no nothing ashamed of the steel guitar.
Right.
And then after that, we'd go on to all kinds of other stuff. And then I'd just pick up an electric guitar and just, I practiced rhythm for 5 years.
That's awesome. Great
because he already had two or three guitar players all the time. And so what I played on guitar was pretty incidental. So I just would sit and practice rhythm stuff. But for the first hour, the pressure was on, but got to play honest to God country steel guitar.
Were you playing old songs and stuff, or was it was all Vince catalog stuff?
Right. Okay. Yeah, I mean, he had 8 million songs.
Oh my God, yeah.
So it was, and you never knew what he was going to do. You never knew what key it was going to be in.
Yeah.
The keys would change all the time because of how he was feeling. Uh-huh. We would do the Opry. We'd do the, when they had the TV show on Saturday nights, we'd go there and there'd be a minute beforehand, we're going to do a certain song in a certain key. By the time we'd get to the stage, that would have changed twice.
How would that come to him? He'd just be like, I'm not feeling those high notes
just,
or what?
And that's it. Yeah. It's just how he felt. And, you know, he's a total feeling guy. So,
and he would just say, hey, Russ, we're going to do this in F tonight.
Yeah. An F, you know, and
crazy.
And the thing is, the hardest part of the whole gig was there was a few songs that were steel heavy that would have a half step mod, and the hardest thing would be to remember what the hell key are we in, and then that half step mod, because these songs would constantly be changing, you know, key wise.
I'm surprised he does that. Like, he seems like so consistent of a performer that
he is, but because he manages it.
Would it be like, hey, everything's down a half step tonight, or was it that song was
You know, most songs were, you know, didn't change, but one he'd go you know, they'd be on the list. I mean, the list would never mean anything either after the first three songs.
Okay.
You know, because he would start
feel.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of times just as it was one of his big hits with a steel introduction, and it was just like just as the count, he'd go E flat tonight, you know, or whatever. So
awesome.
it was good. It was a real challenge. You really had to be on your.
Did you play on any of his records?
No, never.
So you were just the road guy for him.
You know, a bit frustrating. And then when I left. That's when Paul Franklin kind of, I think.
That's when they kind of started.
Things were started, you know, but he'd been recording with them. They were, you know, already. So that was always a bit of a frustration, but I understand it, you know.
So it would come time to make a record and you just wouldn't get the call.
Right.
Okay, weird. Yeah.
Oh, no, that's pretty common.
That's how it goes.
But I mean,
you were a road guy.
I was a road guy. Okay. Well, I'm playing a lot of other people's records.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
But
before that, you did the thing with Dickie Betts, like a bunch of touring. At what point does the session thing really start ticking for you in Nashville?
Oh, early 2000s.
Not till then.
Yeah. No, I'd be out with Vince being his road player. But at the time, there'd be like two, I'd be playing on a top two songs on the charts.
Yeah, yeah.
But for somebody else.
Because you were playing on, like, you've got that interesting thing where you're playing like on all this pretty hip alternative kind of stuff and like all T-Bone stuff.
Uh-huh.
But then you're also playing on like super commercial country stuff
right? Yeah.
Like the roles are different for steel.
But that's what I love because I guess I have a short attention span and I like to think that I can go in and play what's appropriate for the situation. And that has served me really well.
Yeah.
I mean, the first time I worked for T-Bone Burnett, you just mentioned him, was a situation where I had friends who were kind of in his crew. And
so what project was it that you did first with
him?
It
was the, they had already done the Raising Sand album.
Yeah.
And they had already, I'll get, you know, 10 Grammys or whatever, all that business.
Yeah.
And they were working on a second one.
Yeah.
This is about 2000.
I play with Jay Belarus, and so I kind of know the whole.
Okay.
I mean, I don't play with him regularly, but I've made a bunch of records with him, and I have heard the whole.
Well, yeah, and
crazy
things
story.
Were kind of Well, anyhow, Buddy Miller was one of the guys, and Dennis Crouch, the bass player.
Yeah.
They kept going. We've been talking to T-Bone about you. I think T-Bone just wasn't excited about Nashville steel players. He liked. Yeah. He liked
Greg Lease,
but he was in Nashville. And finally, one night about 10 o'clock, Buddy Miller calls me up and said, can you get over to Sound Emporium pretty quick? And I said, yeah, I'll be there in a half hour. So I walk in about 10:30, carrying my guitar and amp into a room with all these heavyweights. They're yep. all starting to work on a song. There's Alison Krauss, Robert Plant's in the control room.
And this is like soon after Raising Sand, right?
Yeah.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Okay. Yeah. So I go in and set up, and I'm, you know, this is pretty intimidating. This is big pressure. And then this big, tall, blonde guy, huge man, walks in and says, "I'm T-Bone. I've heard good things about you."
So you'd never met him?
No. And then he kind of bent down, and as I'm sitting at the steel, he says, "I don't like steel guitar licks." And that's the only direction he's ever given me. It's been 12, 13, 14 years now.
Yeah.
That's the only steel guitar direction he's ever given me.
Don't play any steel guitar licks.
Yes. And we recorded a song that moment, which just came out on the new album.
So there's a bunch of, like, that album is sort of half new and half from 2012 or 13 or whenever that was.
Yeah.
Wow, crazy.
Yeah. So, and then, so I played on that. And then a couple of years ago, we did the new recordings, which is about half the records.
Yeah.
So.
Were those sessions noticeably different, the two 10 years apart Robert Plant, Alison Krauss situations?
Well, the band was more electric the second. You know, it was David Hidalgo on guitar, Bill Frizzell on guitar.
Yeah. Was it all here?
Yeah, over Sound Emporium, yeah. Mm-hmm. We did two sets of sessions for it right before COVID hit.
Rebo was there again?
No, Rebo was.
So that was in the original?
Rebo was in the original, but Rebo overdubbed, I think, quite a bit on the new stuff, but he wasn't there for tracking. So,
but Hidalgo was.
Hidalgo was, and Bill Frizzell. You know, how cool is that to be sitting in a room with those guys? You know, so. Pretty cool. I've been working.
And so what's the situation in a session like that as far as, like, how much direction are you given? And what do you do instinct-wise versus what you think they want? And, like, how do you approach it?
Well, like with T-Bone, like on that stuff, that particular stuff, he would kind of go, play steel on this. Or if it was something that he wasn't feeling, he would have me play Dan Electro bass.
Yeah, because you play a bunch of bass on that.
Yeah. Part. So.
But didn't they have Victor Krauss there?
But Victor and I would, you know, we have, you know, I've known Victor for years. Right. We have an understanding. And when I'm playing, you know, Dan Electro bass, which is not really bass, it's bass guitar, but it's more tic-tac.
Yeah.
And so I play loosely on what the bass player is playing. We have an understanding, and maybe some places we might correlate it, but part of my deal is to play accents and stuff that they might not play. It's kind of like a mid-range guitar.
Do you work that stuff out, or do you just kind of feel it?
You just kind of feel it. When I approach a song, I try to think of a motif in my mind, first off. Well, what is this record going to do? Just a general, you know, and that's like for steel. Mm-hmm. Let's say he says, play steel on this song.
Yeah.
Well, let's just see, do I need to be atmospheric? Do I need to be a hillbilly? Is this a New York song?
Is it running through your head constantly? Like, don't play any steel licks.
No.
Okay,
no,
so you've worked past that.
Well, I'm not a lick player. I never was.
But you can still, like.
To me, it's all about emotion. It's all about milking the instrument for emotion. And So I try not to think that much. That starts excluding too much stuff.
Yeah.
But don't rely on licks. Don't rely on being clever. And steel guitar, a lot of really good steel players tend to learn a lot of the vocabulary and then they try applying it to whatever music.
Yeah.
And to me, you've got to, no, don't play licks, play the emotion rather than the mechanics.
Right. In those sessions, do you end up keeping most of your live tracks or do you go in and like overdub stuff or what do you?
Most of that stuff is live tracks.
Yeah.
And it's kind
of... Are the vocal arrangements done in advance with those guys?
No, usually with Robert and Allison, one or the other would do the track.
Okay.
Because they're still conceptually
figuring
working
it out. And, yeah.
And, you know, then they go and work on it later. There's a couple where they would sing together.
Mm-hmm.
And, God, it's a powerful feeling when you've got them singing in your headphones.
Yeah.
And then you got Bill Frisell playing. And,
amazing.
And, you know, it's just Del Dago, you know.
Yeah.
And then Jay Bellarose. Jay and I have become very, very good friends over the years. And
he's a very nice fellow.
And, yeah, and he is one of the great modern dynamos
and so rhythm. Unpredictable.
Yeah. Just and
that's what
so,
I love about him.
So musical. It's scary how well he plays.
Yeah. Do you get much feedback from Robert Plant?
Yeah. One day I got to the studio a little early and I was just in there noodling around my guitar. He comes in a little early. He comes over and sits down. We start talking and we're, you know, just talking about blues or something. And he was kind of going, yeah, well, we kind of, you know, dinged it up, you know, this British, you know, stuff. And I said, okay, hold it. Wait a second. All due respect. But if it weren't for you guys like you, I wouldn't know blues from a hole in the ground. Because being a white American, I didn't know what blues was until I heard it from you British guys.
Right.
And, believe me, most of the blues I heard was done by you guys first. So that's my favorite.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I love all the old stuff. I don't have the reverence for it that you do or mm-hmm. knowledge, but never discount what you guys did. You
right.
know? And he kind of, okay.
Wow, that's heavy, man.
Yeah.
Shit.
And he is an encyclopedia of old blues records.
Is he really?
Oh, yeah. He knows every label color. He knows every version of everything.
He's really?
Real
I didn't realize that he was so deeply into it.
Oh, yeah. Serious.
Cool. I don't know why I'm focusing on that record other than it's a cool, super cool record. But like, is there a lot of repertoire stuff that gets tossed around that doesn't get used? Or do you guys basically just work on everything that ends up coming out? Or
yeah, most of that stuff is just, we probably cut 15 songs in the last couple sessions and they probably mm-hmm. used half of those.
Okay.
You know, so yeah, there's stuff that doesn't see the light of day, but
tons.
But half that record was cut 10 years ago
yeah.
and didn't see the light of day.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of the way that works.
Right.
You know? So,
yeah, interesting.
You know, some things work, some things don't work, or maybe it's not the right time for something.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. So who are some of the other producers that you really enjoy working with these days?
Well, I do like Dan Auerbach.
What's your take on like what he has sort of brought to the whole scene here?
Because
he's using a lot of the older guys.
He's
sort of doing some pretty cool shit.
Oh, he's
right?
just having a field day, you know. He's
uh-huh.
he's another musicologist who's got an incredible record collection, who just studies all this stuff. And you know, he came to Nashville and he started hooking up with all the legends. And, you know, we ended up with a rhythm section. I came into him actually before he started doing that, once again through Buddy Miller.
Okay.
Dan lived across the alley from Buddy Miller a few years back. And Buddy's one of my favorite producers, too. He has been doing a lot lately, but I've done a lot of stuff with Buddy.
Mm-hmm.
He's a great guy, and we have a great understanding. But Dan... called me and said, well, Buddy said, there's this guy, Dan Auerbach, from the Black Keys. I gave him your phone number. I hope it's okay. I go, yeah, Buddy, it's okay. So,
were you aware of the Black Keys?
Vaguely.
Sort of, yeah.
Vaguely. Well, I knew they were, right then, everything, you know, there was big commercials coming out with their songs on it. Yeah. So I realized this is a big deal. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, Dan called me and said, we're over here at the studio. Can you come over? And so I went and set up, and it was an artist named Bombino, which is a... is it Tuareg tribesmen or something from Africa?
Wow.
East Africa, I guess. And the whole band was in there. And there's all these guys, you know, like maybe they had done a photo shoot or something earlier, but they had like head scarves and all this stuff. And I walked in and he said, just set up a play with the band. And I just jumped into this East African rhythmic stuff.
Yeah, it's a good fit. I mean, absolutely.
So,
there was already guitar players in that band?
Yeah, he's a guitar player. Bombino's is great.
You know?
He's sort of the Santana of.
And
very rhythmic, odd. The bars aren't odd, but their phrasing is odd. And I just had to
It's like John Lee Hooker, right?
Yeah, I sort of had to just feel it rather than try to count it. Yeah. I'm not a very good counter, so. But I mean, when the first song, there was a big steel solo in the middle of it, you know, and it's just me doing my impression. I had no idea what I was doing, but
what was their reaction to what you played? Because that would be
they liked it.
They loved it.
It was just wow, you know. And so I ended up finishing the record with them. Bombino came back to town a couple times. I actually played at a live gig at a bowling alley out on Dickerson Road with him one time.
Wicked,
you know. So. How cool is that? And I just sort of got into the Dan camp, and we've done.
You did Yola's record.
Did Yola?
She lives right next door.
Oh well, if you say hello, if you see her, tell her I said hello. I've done a couple of her records. Did a John Anderson record.
Cool.
We did an Lana Del Rey record, a Ray LaMontagne record.
Yeah,
all kinds of stuff.
What would be some of the hallmarks of working with him? Is he just as much of a live kind of feel guy as T-Bone?
Oh, yeah. And when you're out in the, you know, no click track, no individual headphone mixes, you just go out there and play. And
what sort of feedback do you get from him as far as direction goes?
Well, you know, I've become almost more of a guitar player for him than a steel player. I still do steel guitar stuff, but most of the time I'll play guitar on the tracks.
Okay.
Because I fashion myself as a real wannabe electric rhythm guitarist. That's what I want to be.
I think
be
you've
more
graduated beyond that, you know, point.
But so I love to play on the tracks, and I love to help with the arrangements.
You
know, I'm kind of on the floor guy with Dan. Where, hey Dan, I think if we took half a bar out here, that might work, and that works good. And so I do that, and then steel guitar. It's been a process because he. I used to get frustrated because all he wanted was Pete Drake. That was all he could think about. And I get it, but, you know, but Dan, I'm not Pete Drake.
Why and Pete Drake? He just dug
just
that.
Just loves it. You
just
know?
Dug
well,
it. Okay.
Why anybody loves Pete Drake.
Yeah.
It's just because Pete plays right to the gut. You know, nothing fancy, no licks.
Right.
You know, Pete plays pure emotion.
Yeah.
And so, but I've kind of gone, you know, worked through that with him, but.
But he wants a bit more licky playing than T-Bone
He wants some flash. He's got some ideas about, and really it all would come down to Pete Drake. It's interesting.
That's funny.
But now we just.
Like, if Pete Drake were here, he would.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Or he would go, here, listen to this record. I mean, I'll get texts in the middle of the night. Here, listen to this, you know, some Pete Drake thing. So.
You're like, yeah, I've heard that.
I've had to take the ringer off my texting thing just because I have so many friends that are. Who don't sleep much and are musicologists, and they're always sending me stuff in the oddest hours. And now I start doing that.
Does Dan, when he produces records, is he out on the floor playing too, generally? Or?
You know, he's sort of gotten where he's more in the control room.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's been a kind of a big shift in the way the session band is evolving.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've been through like probably 10 years of, you know, doing records there. And
he's over on 8th South?
8th Avenue. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Got a great studio.
Yeah.
Great guitars. It's a great place. Great engineer. Alan
so do
Parker.
You need to bring a guitar when you go?
I don't need to, but I'm such a nerd that I bring all my Frankenstein guitars.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, what I found about, I have a number of friends who have these beautiful studios and guitar collections. The problem is when these people have, 30 or 40 guitars, they tend not to get maintained enough.
Totally. Yeah.
And I love a guitar that's perfect, and I'm anal about having a guitar set up correctly. Yeah. So I bring all my own. But I still end up using a lot of his.
Yeah.
Or he'll go, you need to play the Sunburst. So he'll bring me his Sunburst Les Paul. And I'm going, yeah, I guess I'll play that.
Who are the other sort of stalwarts in his camp these days? Like, does he use the same drummers and bass players?
Well, he's starting to use Jay Bellarose. Well, actually, we got something coming up in a few weeks. Jay is flying to town for.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Dave Rowe has played bass on a lot of the stuff.
Yeah.
Mike Rojas does a lot of the stuff. Sam Bacco on percussion, Gene Chrisman, Billy Sanford, my father-in-law. I sort of snuck Billy into that camp, and so it's
Would he be now?
Billy just turned 82 the other
Amazing.
Day.
Amazing.
He's doing great. He's recovering from a little knee surgery right now.
He still plays.
He plays. He's like the world's oldest teenager, and
Amazing.
I've got to say, I'm very fussy about guitar players. I'm very critical of guitar players.
Yeah.
Billy, I think, is one of the most incredible natural guitar players
really?
I've ever heard. I sort of parallel him with, of all people, Jeff Beck.
Wow.
I think he's in the same class as Jeff Beck as far as he plays totally inspired from the hip.
Mm-hmm.
He can play. It's like he can play anything he thinks of.
Yeah.
And if you sat down and talked to him, you'd never know. It's not like he's sitting there working on scales or anything.
Mm-hmm.
He just, something comes to him and he manages to make his fingers do it.
Wow.
It's amazing.
What's a good thing to hear him really play on?
Oh, the Keith Whitley records.
Oh,
he played all
that
stuff. There was one big record, I'm No Stranger to the Rain. There's a Waylon Jennings record called Don't Let the Sun Set on Tulsa or whatever. Amazing guitar solo in the middle of it. David Loggins, Please Come to Boston.
Uh-huh.
There's a phase shifter guitar solo in the middle of it. Billy played that.
Okay.
The phase shifter came in the mail that morning. It was like the first phase shifter in Nashville.
Awesome.
But yeah, I mean, we're family and everything, but I think he's one of the most naturally gifted musicians I've ever met.
Is he still actively working or not
he's
so much?
He slowed down a bit, but we still cut with Dan every now and then.
Cool. Yeah. So are you working there fairly often with Dan at his place?
Yeah,
that's great.
Yeah. It's one of my regular haunts.
Yeah. And then Buddy's place, you've done quite a bit of work there
of
over the years.
At Buddy's place,
at the house.
Yep. Yeah. At the house, yeah.
Uh-huh.
So and I did the whole run of Nashville, the TV show.
Oh, right, of course.
Which started with T-Bone, then ended up with Buddy, and then Tim Lauer.
Yeah.
So I played, I probably played whatever, three or four seasons of that.
Okay.
So.
And was there a lot of steel on that stuff, or
not
was it more
a lot.
Guitar?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I played more banjo than
really?
I played guitar, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
It was just, as a session player back in the 90s, I decided every year I was going to add something new to my arsenal.
Yeah.
And I'm a pretty good finger-picking guitar player, so I got a banjo. And in the early 2000s, I was probably the most recorded Nashville banjo player.
Really?
Just because I could play slow, unfancy with a click track, where a lot of really virtuoso banjo players, that's just not in their thing.
Yeah, if you slow it down, they're falling all over themselves.
What
kind of stuff were you playing banjo on?
Oh, just the things like just records by.
But five string banjo.
Five string banjo.
Yeah.
No, not using finger picks. Just
okay.
My
so you
own
sort of
thing.
Had your own thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Basically, it's a sequencer. That's how I approach it.
Yeah.
I would just come up with a pattern that fit over the chords and just stick with it.
Uh-huh.
But that sort of.
So you started getting calls for banjo?
Oh, yeah. I've played whole days of double scale playing banjo.
Wow.
I mean, I'd be in there with Paul Franklin playing steel or Dan Dugmore or something.
Yeah.
And I'm in there playing banjo.
Wow. That's crazy.
It was a short while. Mark Wright, the producer, we did a couple albums where both Dan and Dugmore and I were hired, and we would flip coin, you know, who's going to play steel, who's going to play guitar. We had a great time.
Wow.
You know, I've done sessions with Paul Franklin where I've played guitar and he's played steel.
Yeah. In the 90s, were things pretty busy for you session-wise? Or
incredibly.
They were.
It was mostly demo work, but I
worked. So like showing up in a studio, setting up, doing a three-hour call kind of thing.
Three times a day.
Five days a week. Okay. And that was regular, like you were doing it all the time.
I worked all the time. That was my second 10,000 hours.
Yeah.
Was the 90s playing demos. My first 10,000 hours was Minneapolis playing clubs.
Yeah.
Then there was the second 10,000 hours is the 90s playing demos.
Why did that never really graduate to records at that time?
Because it wasn't my time. As my wife said, it just wasn't. In fact, there was a time when I was just getting this great little foothold, and Dan Dugmore, who I already knew, and we were good friends, he came to town and took all the wind out of my sail.
Really?
I actually got twice different people called me and said, man, we got you booked for the sessions here, but we got a chance to get Dan Dugmore, so I'm going to have to let you go. And that was not very good for the spirits at the time.
Oh, yeah.
And the thing is, Dan Dugmore is one of the most wonderful players.
You want to hate him.
And you know, and it was just, I was so frustrated. But my time came.
So would you say that was like maybe a stylistic thing where what he did was kind of more desirable at that time, whereas now like it's kind of more like what you do time?
I think what it was that part of it.
Because you're very different players.
Yes. Well, we're both kind of the hippie, you know, hippie
right.
steel. But he just came to town at the right time because he had played with James Brown and Linda Ronstadt. And that's what everybody wanted their records to sound like. James Taylor. Sorry.
Okay.
James Taylor and Linda Ronstadt. And he just was had that California element. And
he came to town and he was just like gangbusters.
Oh, here. He came to town, you know, he came to town with a full booking, you know.
Holy shit.
So, oh, and boy, it just broke my heart for
really?
Several years. I mean, it was hard. But eventually, I started.
So was the demo thing a grind or was it cool?
Oh, it was a grind. It was college. It was all of the above. Mm-hmm. You know, some days it was horrible.
Yeah.
Some days it was great.
Yeah.
But I decided I needed to. That was probably the late 90s. I realized I need to really develop my own voice.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I started putting pedal boards together, started rewiring guitars, rethinking how pedals. I had already approached steel guitar more as a guitar player in a lot of ways,
mm-hmm.
but I just took that further and I started doing delay things on tracks where I wasn't even playing steel guitar stuff. I was playing stuff that they might do a sequencer, but I was figuring out how to go do that live. Back before there was, you could dial the BPMs, you had to, before
tap,
there was,
tap it in there.
Was before there was tap, you know. Just, but I had a vision in my head, okay, you need to do this. And I just saw it through. I kind of had a 5-year plan. I said, I'm going to try to invent a new way to make this instrument fit the changing music scene.
Were there some landmark recordings in your mind of your own work where you feel like that started to really come together?
Oh, I don't know if they, you know, stylistic. There was just some hit records that made a difference. You know, Gretchen Wilson's records.
Oh, yeah.
She came out of the box and there was like 3 or 4 number one records off that one album.
So who was producing that stuff?
Mark Wright.
Okay.
Mark Wright.
So you got the call from that just from knowing him or whatever? And
I had worked on a bunch of other stuff with him. And she was around, I was playing on demos with her.
Yeah.
And you know, so we knew each other from that. And
okay.
then we went and cut that Redneck Girl.
Yeah.
And,
so that goes gangbusters. And then, like, does that really, like, immediately your phone starts ringing with people?
No, it's not. But you just notice that suddenly I'm getting more record calls rather mm-hmm. than demo calls.
Right.
But I never quit doing demos. I just kept doing, you know, working overtime, but getting more record calls mm-hmm. and stuff. So, and, you know, records is different. You, generally, it's a slower process. It's much more refined. Sometimes it can be so detail-oriented, frustrated. It's just like, good God, this is beyond perfect. You know, and then some of it just with Mark Wright, you know, we go in first take, here's your record.
Yeah.
You know, and they'd be kind of loose and, you know, but that's what made it a hit. But yeah, I just, you know, gradually realized, wow, I'm actually playing on records now.
You don't really play on demos and stuff anymore, do you?
Well, I did up until COVID. And then when the COVID thing hit, I was just at that point. I had just got old enough to get Social Security mm-hmm. and my pension. And I thought, well, at first, I'm just going to hang out at home. I'm not going to risk going off to sessions right now. So I kind of ended up retiring from a certain level of playing.
Yeah.
And I, if people would call, I would just recommend my younger friends because mm-hmm. they need it more than I do right now.
Yeah.
And so I've sort of, without actually stating it, I sort of got out of that mm-hmm. that strata of playing.
Probably worked really well for you.
Yeah. And also, I like to think I was one of the first digital remote overdubbing pioneers.
Oh, yeah?
In this town. Back in the 90s, I had a hard disk recorder.
Yeah.
I had an FTP site.
I
learned, and I'm not very computer literate, but I learned enough to be able to do overdubs. And I mean, I serviced Canada. I mean, I was playing on more records in Canada.
Through who?
Just like, people I knew, you know, people I knew from playing on demos, and they go, man, can you play on this and play on that?
So who did you play on with from
Jason
Canada? Oh,
Jason McCoy. And,
oh, like the country stuff.
Yeah, the country stuff. Yeah. I did so much of that through the 90s and early 2000s that I got tired of it. And I officially retired. I sold my recording rig.
I said,
I don't want to do any more home overdubs. Well, COVID changed that.
Yeah. And, are you doing some of that again?
Oh, I'm doing a lot of it now.
A lot of it.
Okay. I'm doing it on my terms. It's great. I used to just, I don't know. I got frustrated with it. And I've got a system where.
Frustrated why? Just the lack of any sort of.
Well, part of it at the time, so much of the music, I'd be getting these, you know, rap soundtracks, you know, put Steel on this, make Steel fit in this. And I'm just going, I don't understand this music.
Yeah.
And having to second guess it. And then I used to try to send back an edited perfect piece.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I do is, first off, I know most of the people now that send me stuff. And COVID gave it a license. I mean, now I do records. I do stuff for T-Bone now at my house.
Oh, you
that
did?
Would
yeah.
have never happened
right.
before.
Yeah.
But yesterday I worked on a piece for a movie thing he's working on. And it just said, can you give me an alternate version on this pass? So, you know, I do that.
Cool.
And
did you play on the George and Tammy stuff?
Yeah, we're still working on that.
All right.
And that was great fun because we got to go.
I think it'll be out by the time we air this, so I think we can talk about it.
It's been great fun because. Yeah.
That's an ongoing thing?
Yeah, we've been working on it for the last 6 months, and it's still going on.
You're not on the show, though, are you?
No.
Okay.
I think I'm too old. I realize some of the other guys, younger guys.
My friend Jamie Dix playing drums in the show,
yeah.
I think. Yeah.
Back then they wouldn't have had anybody that old.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Who's that white haired guy? No, it's been great fun. It's been great doing the forensics of all that George and Tammy
stuff.
Yeah,
man. That'd be fun.
And as it turns out, my father-in-law was a session leader on all the Billy Sherrill sessions.
Oh,
Billy.
Shit.
So I've got a real. So it ended up that one of the producers from the show ended up calling me, and I've been sort of a pipeline for information about background for the sessions and stuff.
Awesome.
Through Billy and people like that.
And are you going for like a sound alike thing or not exactly?
A lot of it is sound alike, but as T-Bone said, I don't like Steel X. So I never really copied Pete. I just. Did my I'm unimmersed.
Who plays Steel on that stuff?
Oh, it was Pete Drake.
Oh, it was Pete Drake.
95% of it. Lloyd Green played on a little bit of it.
But how do you play on something like that and not play any steel licks.
Well,
I guess I see what you mean. Like, it's not lick oriented.
No,
playing
no.
I was playing
you know, impression, and then I know most of those songs just by osmosis.
Right.
But it's been really fun. Like, I just did, we did Stand By Your Man, and we did a really good version of it. Mm-hmm. And I did my impression of the record, you know?
Yeah.
Well, they just sent me the track without steel on it again. It says, we're going to use this in another scene where it's a live scene. Can you just give me an alternate steel take like a live player? So it was like, okay, now how would the road player play this?
Right.
And different
psychology.
Like a
little drunker.
yeah. Just probably a little busier, a little more like, hey, you know, listen to me, you know?
Yeah.
So I did that, you know, and that's interesting.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I just did that yesterday morning out at the house.
Wow, so, that's so cool.
It's just, you know, it's interesting how deep you can go with all this stuff.
So do you have a little setup at home that's permanently sort of there?
Yeah, I just got a little. When COVID first hit, I called, I've got a guy up at Sweetwater Music I buy stuff from, and I said, I need a computer. And he said, man, we're just really, everything was like
gone.
And he said, we've got like one iMac here. And I said, send it to me. You know, and so I just have this little iMac and a little Apogee.
Yeah.
And I set it up on my kitchen table.
Yeah.
Or sometimes we have a little place in Kentucky, and then we have a little condo in Donelson. So sometimes I'll bring it, you know, I put it all in a big plastic storage bin, and that's my portable studio.
Wow.
But it does the trick. I mean, the Strymon makes a little thing called the Iridium.
Oh, yeah. Is that cool?
Oh, it's badass.
Really?
I mean, I'm a real hardcore amp guy, but I do most of my recording through the Iridium.
Does it just sound like a Fender amp?
Like a Fender amp. I end up using the Vox model a lot because it just, you know, I don't know if it sounds more like a Vox, but sometimes that's just the sound. It's a little different sound. I like that a lot. But
is it supposed to sound like a mic'd Fender amp?
Yeah,
is that the idea?
It has three settings. It's got a Fender setting, a Vox, and a Marshall, and then like three different speaker models.
Okay.
And it's great. It just doesn't, it's like it doesn't do anything. It's just kind of makes it sound believable.
Huh.
And I've used it with some very discriminating engineers. When I had my amp along, I said, let's try this.
Yeah.
And they're kind of going, oh, okay. And then they go, hey, you sound like you. That's all that matters. And so at the house, I can set up, I mean, my wife can be sitting, you know, next to me doing puzzles or something.
And you're on headphones.
And I'm on headphones, and I'm over there clanking, you know,
great,
the clanking of the steels. Yeah, it's real believable. Strymon.
Yeah, they make some cool shit.
Yeah, if they put something out, usually by the time they put it out, it's pretty well figured out.
Yeah.
They're proud.
Yeah, that Flint pedal for me has been the one where it's like I never don't use that.
Yeah.
Every other pedal I have changes, but that one's always there.
Well, I'm pretty critical as far as tremolo goes.
Yeah.
And it's pretty damn good.
It is pretty damn good.
Yes.
Yeah. I really like the Brown, the bias tremolo.
Oh, yeah.
Sounds amazing.
You know, and I see, I'll use stuff like that with the steel, you know, where it's just... And I think maybe there's a generation of young steel players coming up that maybe have a more open mind. That's one thing about the steel guitar world. There's a sort of, if Buddy or Lloyd didn't do it, why is it isn't worth doing?
Right.
And no disrespect for either one of those guys because they're gods to me.
Yeah.
But I think the instrument has been sort of stilted.
Mm-hmm.
Where people have just, there needs to be more open mind to the instrument. And because I think it's one of the most expressive tone generators there are.
Yeah, man.
And I guess that's what my mission is, to just open those doors. And, you know, I think there's players that do wacky things, but they're kind of missing maybe some technique in the process. And I still think you need to have a good basic working knowledge of the instrument. But I also think you need to have an open mind and don't be afraid to try this stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, check, you know, suss out your situation, you know.
Right.
I think Paul Franklin calls it reading the room.
And it's a perfect expression
for
it.
And, you know, it just depends, you know, you get in and see, what am I needed here? what is our little mission statement here today? Maybe I'm just the hillbilly guy. But then there's some days where I'm the guy who takes this country record and makes it more pop.
Yeah.
You know, it's every day it's different. So it's keeping all that in mind.
Yeah.
And then not playing any licks.
Yeah. Do you get called for much modern country stuff anymore?
Yeah.
You do?
I have a handful of accounts and I still play.
And with that world, do you find, like, my impression is that they kind of want steel, but they don't really want steel.
Yeah, a lot of it is kind of cut and paste, where you'll just go in and record stuff, and it won't be where you put it originally. They'll cut and use, cut and paste, which is fine.
You know?
But I still do a fair amount of it. Yeah.
And do you do any road work these days, or are you just like not into that?
It's tricky times. I've been.
You're not doing the Robert Plant tour?
I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, I was hired for it for a while, and then it sort of went away.
Okay.
I don't know how that's going to play out. Because they had a whole. We were supposed to start this next month, and then COVID sort of.
Did they shit can some of this stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So right. I haven't heard. At this point, I'm not in the loop.
You would tour with Robert Plant.
No, that would be. Well, just I would love to be out there with Jay.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
I hear you.
Jay and I, we have a good time together.
Yeah. Have a few cocktails.
Yeah. He's
He's a cultured.
He's a cultured man. He's a real brother in the music army with me.
Yeah.
You
know,
so
cool, man. Well, this has been so great to have you on.
We did get pretty geeky there. So
we got pretty geeky there. Yeah, way geekier than I usually get, which is fun.
And that's the tip of the icebergs.
I know, right? Well, I think we covered lots of.
All right.
Cool
this
shit.
Has been a pleasure. It's fun to talk.
Thank you. Folks, that was my conversation with Russ Paul. I had a blast talking with him, and I hope you enjoyed listening to it. We shall see you in a couple weeks for another chilling episode of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. We'll see you then. Music Makers and Soul Shakers is produced at the Hen House Studio in Nashville, Tennessee by Steve Dawson. Please remember to subscribe to the show and follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. You can find more info on this episode, including show notes and an audio playlist at makersandshakerspodcast.com. Thanks again to our amazing sponsors this season, Ear Trumpet Labs, Union Tube and Transistor, Black Mountain Picks, Isotope, and Spectra 1964. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.